Hello, Sense Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. I'm going to read the major news articles from the Monday, September 8th, 2025 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's find out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather, sunny, highs near 100 degrees Fahrenheit, winds west-northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight's forecast, clear skies, lows to 76 degrees Fahrenheit, winds south-southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow's forecast predicts, except for a few afternoon clouds, mainly sunny. Highs to 102 degrees Fahrenheit, winds south-southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. We'll begin with the reading of the first article of the Arizona Daily Star front page titled, South Korea Will Bring Back Home Workers. This article was written by Hyung-Yin Kim of the Associated Press, Dateline Seoul, South Korea. More than 300 South Korean workers detained following a massive immigration raid at a Hyundai plant in Georgia will be released and brought home, the South Korean government announced Sunday. Kang Hoon-sik, Chief of Staff for President Lee Jae-myung, said that South Korea and the U.S. finalized negotiations on the workers' release. He said South Korea plans to send a charter plane to bring the workers home as soon as remaining administrative steps are completed. Foreign Minister Cho Ho-yeon is to leave for the U.S. on Monday for talks related to the workers' releases, South Korean media reported. U.S. immigration authorities said Friday they detained 475 people, most of them South Korean nationals, when hundreds of federal agents raided Hyundai's sprawling manufacturing site in Georgia, where the Korean automakers makes electric vehicles. Agents focused on a plan that is still under construction at which Hyundai partnered with LG Energy Solution to produce batteries that power EVs. Cho said that more than 300 South Koreans were among the detained. The operation was the latest in a long line of workplace raids conducted as part of the Trump administration's mass deportation agenda. But the one on Thursday is especially distinct because of its large size and the fact that state officials have long called the targeted site Georgia's largest economic development project. The raid stunned many in South Korea because the country is a key U.S. ally. It agreed in July to purchase $100 billion in U.S. energy and make a $350 billion investment in the U.S. in return for the U.S. lowering tariff rates. About 2 weeks ago, U.S. President Donald Trump and Lee held their first meeting in Washington. Lee said the rights of South Korea nationals and economic activities in South Korea companies must not be unfairly infringed upon during U.S. law enforcement procedures. South Korea's foreign ministry separately issued a statement to express concern and regret over the case and sent diplomats to the site. Video released by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement on Saturday showed a caravan of vehicles driving up to the site and then federal agents directing workers to line up outside. Some detainees were ordered to put their hands up against the bus as they were frisked and then shackled around their hands, ankles, and waist. Most of the people detained were taken to an immigration detention center in Folkestone, Georgia, near the Florida state line. None has been charged with any crimes yet, Stephen Schrank, the lead Georgia agent of Homeland Security Investigations, said during a news conference Friday, adding that the investigation was ongoing. He said that some of the detained workers illegally crossed the U.S. border, while others entered the country legally but had expired visas or entered on a visa waiver that prohibited them from working. Kang, the South Korean presidential chief of staff, said that South Korea will push to review and improve visa systems for those traveling to the U.S. on business trips for investment projects. The next front page article is titled, U.S. Students Without Legal Status Targeted. This article was written by Kate Payne of the Associated Press Report for America. Dateline Tallahassee, Florida. Carly hoped to spend her senior year savoring her final moments on the palm tree-lined campus of the University of Central Florida. Instead, she sits at home alone, logging on to online courses, afraid to leave her apartment and run the risk of being detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. A few months ago, Carly was studying public relations in Orlando, envisioning one day working for nonprofits that help students like her. Thanks to in-state tuition and private scholarships, Carly lived a life she only dreamed of in Haiti, a country she left behind at 13 years old. Now she's one of thousands of Florida students whose education is delayed or derailed after state lawmakers revoked a 2014 law that let residents who are in the country illegally qualify for in-state tuition at public colleges and universities. Across the United States, tens of thousands of college students without legal status are losing access to in-state tuition in an immigration crackdown carried out by President Donald Trump and his allies. "It feels like all my hard work means nothing, like one day I can just lose it," said Carly, who spoke on condition of being identified by only her first name, as she fears of being deported. When Florida lawmakers passed the tuition waiver law more than a decade ago, it was a partisan effort championed by then-State Representative Jeanette Nunez, a Miami Republican who went on to become Governor Ron DeSantis' lieutenant governor. That Nunez would support dismantling one of her signature achievements is a sign of how much the state's immigration politics shifted towards Trump's priorities. According to state data, more than 6,500 students qualified for what's known as the out-of-state tuition waiver during the 2023-2024 school year. That was revoked as of July 1st after DeSantis signed the bill repealing the tuition cuts. The cost difference is substantial. At the flagship University of Florida, a state resident is estimated to pay about $6,380 in tuition for the 2025-2026 academic year, compared with about $30,900 for a non-resident student. Housing, transportation, and other expenses can add another $17,000 or more. Florida state colleges and universities don't specifically track the enrollment of students without legal status, but some immigration advocates say they expect fewer students to attend in-person classes, and many may give up on college. Diego Dulanto Falcon earned a bachelor's in psychology thanks to the tuition waiver. Now he's pursuing his master's in public health at the University of South Florida. In losing access to in-state tuition, Dulanto Falcon said, students without legal status are cut off from opportunities. "Fully undocumented students, they have absolutely no options," he said. "They either work under the table or they just don't work at all." Going to high school in Miami, David stacked his schedule with dual enrollment and advanced placement classes. He hoped to attend college and become a radiologist for a physical therapist. David, who was born in Honduras, said that now feels impossible for students like him without legal status. While his friends went off to universities, David went to work at McDonald's. He spoke on condition of being identified only by his middle name because he fears deportation. "When you come into this country and your parents make the sacrifice and you're a kid, all they tell you is focus on school," David said. "I did just that." Without the tuition waiver, he said he can't afford college. Across the U.S., programs offering in-state tuition rates to immigrants that once had wide bipartisan support increasingly came under criticism from Republicans. In legal challenges, the Trump administration argued the benefits are unconstitutional. The Justice Department sued states to end tuition breaks, starting with Texas in June, followed by Kentucky, Minnesota, and Oklahoma. Meanwhile, the U.S. Department of Education is investigating colleges that offer scholarships to students without legal status. Rosie Kurtz, a high school math teacher in the Dallas Independent School District, worries she won't be able to motivate her students to learn algebra if they feel college is out of reach. A Texas law gave college students without legal residency access to in-state tuition for decades before a federal judge blocked it in June. The idea that all can be snatched away from them in such a cruel fashion is demotivating to the whole educator's mindset, Curtis said in a call with reporters. In Orlando, Carly had a private scholarship to attend Central Florida, but it only covered the in-state tuition rate. She was able to enroll as an online student at Purdue Global University, but she said some of her credits didn't transfer and she had to change her major, delaying her graduation. Going to school in person in Florida was no longer an option after more than a dozen colleges and universities, including UCF, signed agreements allowing ICE to carry out raids on campus, she said. I chose online school because I simply don't feel safe, Carly said. She worries that if she were detained, it would be days before someone noticed she was missing. She lives on food she gets delivered to her apartment as she tries to finish her education. I'm trying to get my life back on track, Carly said. I can't stay home forever. Our next front page article is titled, Social Security Has Rolled Out New Chatbot. This article was written by Darius Tahir of the Miami Herald. John McGing couldn't reach a human. That might be business as usual in this economy, but it wasn't business. He had called the Social Security Administration, where the questions often aren't generic and the callers tend to be older, disabled, or otherwise vulnerable Americans. McGing calling on behalf of his son had an in-the-weeds question, how to prevent overpayments that the federal government might later claw back. His call was intercepted by an artificial intelligence-powered chatbot. No matter what he said, the bot parroted canned answers to generic questions. Not McGing's obscure query. If you do a key press, it didn't do anything, he said. Eventually, the bot glitched or whatever and got him to an agent. It was a small but revealing incident. Unbeknownst to McGing, a former Social Security employee in Maryland, he had encountered a technological tool recently introduced by the agency. Former officials and longtime observers of the agency say the Trump administration rolled out a product that was tested but deemed not yet ready during the Biden administration. With the new administration, they're just kind of like, let's go fast and fix it later, which I don't agree with because you're going to generate a lot of confusion, said Marcela Escobar Alava, who served as Social Security Chief Information Officer under President Joe Biden. Some 74 million people receive Social Security benefits. 11 million of those receive disability payments. In a survey conducted last fall, more than a third of recipients said they wouldn't be able to afford such necessities of food, clothing, or housing without it, and yet the agency has been shedding the employees who serve them. Some 6,200 have left the agency. Its commissioner told lawmakers in June and critics in Congress and elsewhere say that's led to worse customer service despite the agency's efforts to build up new technology. Take the new phone bot. At least some beneficiaries don't like it. Social Security Facebook page is from time to time pockmarked with negative reviews of the uncooperative bot, but as the agency said in July, that nearly 41% of calls are handled by the bot. Lawmakers and former agency employees worry it foreshadows a less human Social Security in which brushed-out AI takes out the place of pushed-out experienced employees. Anxieties across party lines. Concern over the direction of the agency is bipartisan. In May, a group of House Republicans wrote to the Social Security Administration expressing support for the government efficiency but cautioning that their constituents had criticized the agency for inadequate customer service and suggesting that some measures may be overly burdensome. The agency's commissioner, Frank Pisigliano, a former Wall Street executive, is a tech enthusiast. He has a laundry list of initiatives on which to spend the $600 million in new tech money in the Trump administration's fiscal 2026 budget request. He's gotten testy when asked whether his plans mean he'll be replacing human staff with AI. You referred to SSA being on an all-time staffing low. It's also at an all-time technological high, he snapped at one Democrat in a House hearing in late June. But former Social Security officials are more ambivalent. In interviews with KFF Health News, people who left the agencies, some speaking on the condition of anonymity for fear of retribution from the Trump administration and its supporters, said they believe the new administration simply rushed technologies developed but deemed not yet ready by the Biden administration. They also said the agency is firing of thousands of employees resulted in the loss of experienced technologists who are best equipped to roll out these initiatives and address their weaknesses. Social Security's new AI phone tool is making it even harder for people to get help over the phone and near impossible if someone needs an American Sign Language interpreter or translator. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, told KFF Health News, "We should be making it as easy as possible for people to get the Social Security they've earned." Spokespeople for the agency did not reply to questions from KFF Health News. Using AI to automate customer service is one of the buzziest businesses in Silicon Valley. In theory, the new breed of artificial intelligence technology can respond smoothly in a human-like voice to just about any question. That's not how the Social Security Administration's bot seems to work, with users reporting canned, unrelated responses. The Trump administration has eliminated some online statistics that obscured its true performance, said Kathleen Roeming, a former agency official who is now director of Social Security and Disability Policy at the left-leaning Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. The old website showed that most callers waited 2 hours for an answer. Now the website doesn't show waiting times, either for phone inquiries, once callback wait times accounted for, or appointment scheduling. While statistics are being posted that show beneficiaries receive help, that is, using AI bot or the agency's website to accomplish tasks, like getting a replacement card, Roeming said she thinks it's a very distorted view overall. Reviews of the AI bot are often poor, she said. Agency leaders and employees who first worked on the AI product during the Biden administration anticipated those types of difficulties. Escobar Alovana said they had worked on such a bot but wanted to clean up the policy and regulation data it was relying on first. We wanted to ensure that the automation produced consistent and accurate answers, which was going to take more time, she said. Instead, it seems the Trump administration opted to introduce the bot first and troubleshoot later, Escobar Alava said. Roeming said one former executive told her that the agency had used canned FAQs without modifications or nuances to accommodate individual situations and was monitoring the technology to see how well it performed. Escobar Alava said she has heard similarly. To Bisignano, automation and web services are the most efficient ways to assist the program's beneficiaries. In a letter to Warren, he said that agency leaders are transforming SSA into a digital-first agency that meets customers where they want to be met, making changes that allow the vast majority of calls to be handled either in an automated fashion or by having a human return the customer's call. Using these methods also relieves burdens on otherwise beleaguered field offices, Bisignano wrote. Altering the phone experience is not the end of Bisignano's tech dreams. The agency asked Congress for some $600 million in additional funding for investments, which he intends to use for online scheduling, detecting fraud, and much more, according to a list submitted to the House in late June. But outside experts and former employees said that Bisignano overstated the novelty of the ideas he presented to Congress. The agency has been updating its technology for years, but that does not necessarily mean thousands of its workers are suddenly obsolete, Roeming said. It's not bad that the upgrades are continuing, she said, but progress has been more incremental than revolutionary. Some changes focus on spiffing up the agency's public face. Bisignano told House lawmakers that he oversaw a redesign of the agency's performance statistics page to emphasize the number of automated calls and de-emphasize statistics about call wait times. He called the latter stats discouraging and suggested that displaying them online might dissuade beneficiaries from calling. Warren said Bisignano has since told her privately that he would allow an inspector general audit of their customer service quality data and pledged to make a list of performance information publicly available. The agency has since updated its performance statistics page. Other changes would come at greater cost and effort. In April, the agency rolled out a security authentication program for direct deposit changes requiring beneficiaries to verify their identity in person if what the agency describes in regulatory documents as an automated analysis systems detects anomalies. According to documents accompanying the proposal, the agency estimated about 5.8 million beneficiaries would be affected and that it would cost the federal government nearly $1.2 billion, mostly driven by staff time devoted to assisting claimants. The agency is asking for nearly $7.7 billion in the upcoming fiscal year for payroll overall. Christopher Hensley, a financial advisor in Houston, said one of his clients called him in May after her bank changed its routing number and Social Security stopped paying her, forcing her to borrow money from her family. It turned out that the agency had flagged her account for fraud. Hensley said she had to travel 30 minutes to the nearest Social Security office to verify her identity and correct the problem. The next front page article is titled Museum Highlights U.S. Genius, Ugliness. This article was written by Calvin Howard of the Associated Press, Dateline Washington, in an afternoon's walk through the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Objects around every corner invite one question. What could possibly be more American than this? The museum explores the complexity of our past in according with its mission statement. There's the enormous Star-Spangled Banner, Dorothy's ruby slippers from The Wizard of Oz, and totems of achievement throughout. There are also testaments of pain and cruelty illustrated by shackles representing slavery and photos of Japanese Americans confined to detention camps in World War II. President Donald Trump wants Smithsonian museums to mirror American pride, power, and accomplishment without all the darkness, and threatened to hold back money if they don't. On social media, Trump complained that at the Smithsonian museums, which are free to visit and get most of their money from the government, everything discussed how terrible our country is, how bad slavery was, and how unaccomplished the downtrodden have been. Nothing about success, nothing about brightness, nothing about the future. In fact, the History Museum reflects bountiful successes on battlefields, from the kitchens and the factories of food pioneers, on the musical stage and the movies and other fronts of creativity and industriousness. The American Enterprise exhibit, for one, has a wall filled with stories of successful Americans. On this wandering tour, you can see navigational implements used by the pirate Blackbeard from his early 1700s raids on the Atlantic coast. You see the hat Abraham Lincoln wore to Ford's Theater on the night of his assassination. George Washington's ceremonial uniform, Warren Harding's red silk pajamas from the early 1900s, and the first car to travel across the United States, and a $100,000 bill. You can see the original light bulbs of the American genius Thomas Edison. Founding father Benjamin Franklin is represented as a gifted inventor and a slave owner who publicly denounced slavery, yet never freed his own. Those nuances and ambiguities may not be long for this world. Still on display at the History Museum are artifacts and documents of the American ingenuity, subjugation, generosity, racism, grit, dishonor, verve, playfulness, corruption, heroism, and cultural appropriation. In the great debate of an American democracy exhibition, a wall is emblazoned with large words including privilege and slavery. The museum presents fulsome tributes to the contributions of immigrants and narratives about the racist landscape that many encountered. Exhibits address food justice, the exploitation of Filipinos after the U.S. annexed their land, and the network of oppressive Native American boarding schools from which Jim Thorpe emerged and became one of the greatest athletes of all time. Hawaii's last sovereign before its annexation by the U.S. in the 1890s, Queen Lilikualina, is quoted on a banner as asking, "Is the American Republic of States to degenerate and become a colonizer? A ukulele on display was made about 1890 by a sugar laborer who worked on the kingdom's American plantations before a U.S.-backed coup overthrew the monarchy. Museum visitors are told the new instrument was held up by the monarchs as a symbol of anti-colonial independence. Ukuleles are both a product of U.S. imperialism and a potent symbol of native Hawaiian resistance, says the accompanying text. At the Greek godlike statue of George Washington, the text hints at his complexities and stops short of the total reverence that totalitarian leaders get. Noting that modern scholarship focuses on the fallible man rather than the marble hero, the text says, Washington's image is still used for inspiration, patriotism, and commercial gain, and he continues to hold a place for many as a symbolic father of the country. Conservators of the museum are restoring the gunboat Philadelphia, part of a small fleet that engaged the British Navy at the Battle of Valancourt Island in Lake Champlain in 1776, displaying Britain's effort to cut off the New England colonies and buying time for the colonial army to prepare for its decisive victory at Saratoga. The commander of the gunboats of the Valancourt Battle later became America's greatest traitor, Benedict Arnold. The British damaged the Philadelphia so badly it sank an hour after the battle, lying underwater for 160 years. It's being restored for the next year's celebration of America's 250th year. The Philadelphia is a symbol of how citizens of a newly formed nation came together despite overwhelming odds against their success, said Jennifer Jones, the project's director. This boat's fragile condition is symbolic of our democracy. It requires the nation's attention and vigilance to preserve it for future generations. Democracy's fragility is considered in a section about the limits of presidential power. That's where the references to Trump, two impeachments were removed in July for updating and were restored in recent days. On December 18, 2019, the House impeached Donald Trump for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, one label now states. On January 13, 2021, Donald Trump became the first president to be impeached twice, says another. The charge was incitement of insurrection based on his challenge of the 2020 election results and on his speech on January 6, 2021, that precipitated his supporters' attack on the U.S. Capitol. His Senate acquittals were duly noted. It's just the facts taken on a matter that drove the country so deeply apart. Now we'll pause the broadcast reading for a reminder that you are listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. The title of the first article is How to Get New COVID Vaccine in Arizona. This article was written by Stephanie Innes of the Arizona Republic. Mesa resident Jane Kerspel had no problem getting her recent annual flu shot, but when she asked her pharmacist for an updated COVID-19 vaccine, she learned that she needed a prescription. Kerspel, a 64-year-old retired state employee, doesn't have a primary care doctor. As a former smoker, Kerspel worried that if she got COVID-19, she'd be at risk for a bad outcome. For now, Arizonans who do not appear to be able to get the updated COVID-19 vaccine from pharmacies in the state unless they have a prescription. Some states, including Massachusetts, Colorado, and New Mexico, have stepped in to remedy barriers to getting the COVID-19 vaccine in pharmacies in their states. Oregon, Washington, and California on September 3rd formed a healthcare alliance to provide evidence-based guidance on immunizations in response to recent federal actions. And on September 4th, Hawaii joined the effort too. Arizona has not announced any similar action. The Arizona Republic reached out to the governor's office and to the Arizona Department of Health Services, but did not receive a response. Two major issues are in play with the COVID-19 vaccine in Arizona. The first is federal. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration rolled back eligibility for the vaccine to people older than 65 and to people younger than 65 who have an underlying health condition that would put them at risk for a severe COVID-19 outcome. That's a significant difference from prior years when the FDA approved the COVID-19 vaccine for everyone over the age of 6 months. The second issue appears to be with Arizona. Outside of public health emergencies and some other exceptions, Arizona statutory law says pharmacies generally cannot administer vaccines without a prescription unless they are recommended by the U.S. Centers for Health, or rather the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, or formally approved separately by the Arizona Department of Health Services. That committee has not met yet to consider the updated COVID-19 vaccines. States like Colorado, with laws similar to Arizona's, have intervened to allow pharmacists to administer the updated COVID shots without ACIP's approval so that patients won't need prescriptions to get them. ACIP was scheduled to meet September 18th, however, Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican of Louisiana, is calling for the meeting to be delayed indefinitely amid turmoil within the CDC and congressional efforts to remove Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services. Arizona has ways to provide wider access to the vaccines and pharmacies, according to James Hodge Jr., professor and director of the Center for Public Health Law and Policies at Arizona State University Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. Arizona has three routes to get around it, and honestly, there's no reason in my view that Arizona can't make available these vaccines across the state to everyone who wants them, Hodge said. No one is handing them out for free like they were during the public health emergency tied to the pandemic, but assuring access legally at least is entirely possible. Hodge said one pathway Arizona could take to allow pharmacists to administer the updated vaccine now is for Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs, to declare a public health emergency around the lack of access to COVID-19 vaccines and use that declaration to waive existing legal barriers. Other legal pathways could include action by the state health department to internally list the updated COVID-19 vaccine as one of the shots that pharmacies in the state could administer. The third avenue is for collaborative practice agreement that may allow pharmacists to administer the shot without prescription subject to restrictions, Hodge said. Anyone in Arizona who wants a COVID-19 vaccine without prescription needs to get it administered by a health provider, which means a setting like doctor's office, urgent care, or one of CVS's Minute Clinics, which as of September 5th had appointments available for the Pfizer and Moderna shots. There are three updated COVID-19 vaccines on the market. Pfizer's Comirnaty COVID-19 vaccine for those 5 years or older, Moderna's Spikevax for those 6 months or older, and Novavax's Novavaxovid for those 12 years or older. Major pharmacy chains are making vaccine appointments, but scheduling portals for both Walgreens and CVS pharmacies as of September 5th said patients would need a prescription and specified the FDA's new parameter for getting the updated vaccines. Patients older than 65 and patients under the age of 65 with at least one underlying health condition. Adding to the confusion is uncertainty as to whether health insurance will pay for the COVID-19 vaccine if patients fall outside of the FDA parameters. The Arizona Republic reached out to the state's Medicaid program, which is called the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, or AHCCS, to ask about coverage for COVID-19 vaccines, but did not hear back. AHCCS is a government health insurance program primarily for people who are low income or have disabilities. Until more guidance becomes available, patients should consult with a physician or other healthcare professional about their individual risks and options for getting vaccinated, said Dr. Jason Jameson, who was president of the Arizona Medical Association. We recognize this poses an additional barrier for patients seeking vaccines and encourage them to leverage telehealth services and urgent care centers in addition to the physician's clinics, Jameson said in an email statement to the Republic. Physicians are disappointed in federal health policy officials' approach to vaccine eligibility requirements and recommendations, especially in their communications with patients. Jameson said the confusion is particularly troubling as health experts anticipate a swell in COVID-19 cases ahead of the holiday season. Chandler family physician Dr. Andrew Carroll said he'll be giving updated COVID-19 vaccines to his patients regardless of their eligibility under the FDA requirements. He doesn't have the updated vaccines in stock yet, but they were expected soon, he said. Carroll cited recent research published in the journal Frontiers in Public Health that found 7.7% of 1,979 Chicago area healthcare workers surveyed in the summer of 2023 had long COVID, which was associated with higher levels of burnout, anxiety, and depression. The findings underscore the value in preventing COVID-19, Carroll said. When they are my patients, I advise them the same way I advise them over the past 5 years. You should get it because it reduces the risk of long-term complications and the possibilities that you can be really sick and hospitalized, Carroll said. I've been there. I worked in the hospital during the whole COVID surge and have observed the severity of the illness, and I would hate to think that anyone would have to go through that unnecessarily. Krupsel was able to get the updated vaccine September 4th at a Walgreens near her home. She made an appointment with a doctor via telehealth who wrote her prescription and sent it to Walgreens. But the process wasn't easy. Krupsel had to explain the situation over and over again, she said, because a telehealth doctor was in another state and told her she didn't need a prescription for a COVID-19 vaccine. Though it initially appeared that the shot was going to cost her $222, Krupsel said she now believes that her insurance company, which is UnitedHealthcare, paid the bill. So far, she has had no out-of-pocket costs. Our next article is titled, Could Phoenix Crime Rate Draw the National Guard? This article was written by Nick Carmia of the Cronkite News. President Donald Trump has not floated the possibilities of sending troops into Arizona. But the violent crime rate in Phoenix is higher than the rate in Chicago, the next city on the president's list. The rate of violent crime per capita in Phoenix is high enough to rank 51st among cities of 100,000 or more. Chicago ranks 108th. Washington, D.C. is 34th. Since August 11th, Trump has deployed about 2,200 National Guard troops to patrol the nation's capital. Chicago is next. We're going in, he said Tuesday in the Oval Office. Chicago is a hellhole right now. Baltimore is a hellhole right now. I have an obligation. Baltimore ranks fourth among mid-sized and large U.S. cities with 1,600 violent crimes per 100,000 residents, though the number of such crimes dropped 5% last year. But Democrats are opposed to Trump's deployment of troops and federal agents say fighting crime doesn't seem to be his main priority. President Trump has used D.C. residents as props in his political play to showcase his own power, said D.C.'s non-voting delegate in the House, Eleanor Holmes Norton. At a news conference Wednesday at the Capitol, she and fellow Democrats from Illinois, Maryland, New York, and Washington State accused Trump of using non-existent lawlessness as a pretext. We don't need Trump's troops on our streets. What we need and what our constituents continue to say is that we need an investment in our neighborhoods, said Representative Delia Ramirez of Illinois. On Thursday, D.C. Attorney General Brian Schwab filed a federal lawsuit accusing the Trump administration of violating laws against military involvement in domestic policing. The lawsuit also asserts Trump's moves have harmed the city's economy by scaring away visitors and notes that by law only Congress, not the president, has authority over the federal district. The deployment includes 800 troops from the D.C. National Guard and others from six states with Republican governors. Those militias have not been federalized, and local government hasn't requested their presence. D.C. argues that means it's unlawful for them to operate outside their own states. The administration should talk to mayors and ask them, how can we best support you if you really want to be helpful to cities across America? Said Representative Greg Stanton, Democrat of Phoenix, a former mayor of Phoenix. Trump floated an intervention in New Orleans on Wednesday, which Louisiana's Republican government says he would welcome. He mentioned Oakland, California as another possibility 3 weeks ago. California's Democratic governor said he's opposed. If violent crime is the only criteria, murder, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault, Phoenix might well catch Trump's eye. Violent crime per capita in Phoenix rose 2% in 2024, according to an analysis of FBI data by Cronkite News. FBI figures show an 11% drop in Chicago's rate from 2023 to 2024. In D.C., violent crime was down nearly 9% in that period. Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego, a Democrat, declined to comment on whether she would welcome a surge of troops and federal law enforcement. Most of the nation's Democratic governors have criticized Trump's actions, issuing a joint statement last week that called the deployments an alarming abuse of power, as well as unnecessary and illegal. Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs was one of four Democratic governors who did not sign on. Her office said she would not comment on the hypothetical possibility of federal intervention. And eight noted that Hobbs expressed disapproval when Trump sent troops into Los Angeles in June. Representative Andy Biggs of Gilbert, who was running for governor in next year's GOP primary, has introduced two bills to support Trump's moves in Washington. The Make D.C. Safe Again Act would allow presidential control over the city's Metropolitan Police Department during emergencies for up to 180 days, up from the current 30-day limit. Another proposal from Biggs would eliminate the option of cashless bail in D.C., tracking a Trump policy. When our nation's capital faces lawlessness, violent crime, and breakdowns in public order, the federal government has a responsibility and a constitutional duty to act decisively, Biggs said last week in a statement announcing the proposals. Other Arizona Republicans in Congress, including Representative Eli Crane of Oro Valley and Abe Habani of Scottsdale, have also expressed support for Trump's use of the National Guard in Washington. Trump says the federal intervention has eliminated crime in D.C. It's now a safe zone, he told reporters earlier this week. We have no crime. It's in such great shape. Washington is unique that Congress has ultimate say over its local governance. But it's 700,000 residents lack voting representation at the federal level. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, a Democrat, has credited Trump's effort with reducing crime. Other city officials have denounced her for failing to push back against the president. In Illinois, Governor J.B. Pritzker and Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, both Democrats, strongly objected to any federal intervention. The White House has not said when troops would be sent. On Saturday, Johnson signed an executive order prohibiting Chicago police from cooperating with military personnel or federal law enforcement on any unlawful or unconstitutional actions. In June, the president sent 700 Marines and 4,000 California National Guard members to Los Angeles in response to protests over his immigration crackdown over the objections of Governor Gavin Newsom and Mayor Karen Bass, both Democrats. On Tuesday, a federal district court judge ruled that that move violated the Posse Comitatus Act an 1878 law that prohibits the military from performing civilian policing functions. The administration filed an appeal, and Trump called the judge radical. The D.C. Attorney General's lawsuit also cites Posse Comitatus, the danger that such an operation poses to individual liberty and democratic is self-evident, the lawsuit says. The title of our next article is Senators Demand Answers from DHS. This article was written by Emily Bregel of the Arizona Daily Star. Arizona's U.S. Senators, Democrats Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego, are among dozens of legislators demanding answers from the Department of Homeland Security on two immigration issues: the recent arrests of immigrants brought to the United States as children, despite their protected status, and the targeting of military families and veterans for arrest and deportation. In a September 3rd letter to the DHS Secretary Kristi Noem, 41, legislators asked the agency to clarify its position on immigrants with protection under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, known as DACA, DACA. The Obama-era program was created to offer temporary protection from deportation to immigrants who were brought to the United States as children. But in recent months, immigration agents have targeted DACA recipients for arrests, actions lawmakers called illegal. In statements to media outlets, including the Arizona Daily Star, DHS Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin justified the arrests by claiming DACA recipients don't actually have protection from deportation and urging DACA recipients to self-deport, contradicting government guidance of the program. In contrast to Mrs. McLaughlin's puzzling statement, the lawmaker's letter said, public DHS guidance makes clear that DACA holders are not considered to be unlawfully present in the United States, and that an individual who has received deferred action is authorized by DHS to be in the United States for the duration of the deferred action period. DHS has not responded to the Star's request for a response to the letter. A path to permanency for unauthorized immigrants brought to the United States as kids, known broadly as Dreamers, has long had bipartisan public support, and in December, then-President-elect Donald Trump expressed his support for allowing Dreamers to stay in the United States. DACA recipients must meet strict criteria and renew their status every 2 years to maintain their permission to work and authorization to remain in the U.S. There are more than 525,000 active DACA recipients today, mostly under the age of 36, but including some in their 40s. In a January decision, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals maintained a stay that protects current DACA holders and also limited a nationwide injunction on new DACA approvals to Texas, a letter from the legislators said. We urge you to retract Assistant Secretary McLaughlin's statement and ensure that DHS recognizes and abides by the protections of DACA moving forward, the letter said. Recent enforcement actions against DACA recipients not only appear to violate the Fifth Circuit stay, but also disrupts families, harms communities, and inflict unnecessary social, emotional, and economic costs. In a second letter to DHS and Department of Defense officials, 61 legislators, including Kelly and Gallego, announced the opening of an investigation into the Trump administration's betrayal of non-citizen military service members, veterans, and military families by targeting them for immigration enforcement. We demand an explanation for why DHS is betraying its promises to service members who play a key role in protecting U.S. national security, the letter said. Citing a new ICE policy implemented in April, reversing guidance that considered military service a significant mitigating factor in deciding whether to pursue enforcement action. In an email statement to the Star, DHS said, DHS and ICE value the contributions of all those who have served in the U.S. military, U.S. military service alone does not automatically grant lawful immigration status or exempt aliens from the consequences of violating U.S. immigration laws. Kelly's office highlighted the case of Maria Perez, who has lived in the U.S. for 20 years and has no criminal record. Perez was detained when she entered the Marine Corps Air Station in Yuma to help her son and daughter-in-law, both U.S. Marines, care for their two-year-old son while the daughter-in-law recovered from surgery. An immigration judge granted Perez release on bond, but ICE appealed the decision, Kelly said. In the Friday email to the Star, DHS said, Perez will be released on bond once her bond payment is made, but did not say whether ICE had lost its appeal. The letter also cited the May arrest of a Marine Corps veteran's wife who was still breastfeeding her young child at the time. After more than 10 years living in the U.S., she was detained during a green card application appointment. And the letter highlighted the arrest of the father of three U.S. Marines during a June workplace raid. NPR reported that the man was repeatedly punched by masked ICE agents during the arrest. More than 40,000 foreign nationals were serving in the armed forces as of February 2024, and more than 115,000 foreign nationals in the U.S. were veterans of the U.S. military in 2022, according to the lawmaker's letter. Non-citizens often possess specialized skills valuable to the military, especially in certain medical specialties and foreign languages that are difficult for military recruiters to find and expensive to teach, the letter said. Non-citizens can also be critical in helping the military meet its recruitment goals, and they have had higher retention rates than citizens. Lawmakers said the enforcement actions go against decades of precedent and long-standing DHS policy indicating that military service offers protection from immigration enforcement for military service members, veterans, and their immediate family members. The Trump administration's actions threaten U.S. national security interests and erode the U.S. military's credibility when it makes promises to its service members who have put their lives on the line for our country. Legislators asked DHS and DOD to respond by September 16th to the letter's request for more information, including the number of non-citizens serving in the U.S. military and the impact of new enforcement policies on recruitment, readiness, and morale. A DOD spokesperson said in a Friday statement, as with all congressional correspondence, the department will respond directly to the requester. We have nothing more to provide. The title of our next article is Port of Entry Being Built in Douglas. This article was written by David Oluya Jr. of the Arizona Republic. Senator Mark Kelly, the mayor of Douglas, and several other U.S. and Mexican government officials came together recently to celebrate the groundbreaking ceremony for a new $325 million commercial port of entry. The new port of entry is expected to create jobs and bring goods from construction materials to produce. The groundbreaking also comes months after Chris Mayer's Arizona Attorney General filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration over tariffs on goods such as Mexican-grown tomatoes. When completed, U.S. Customs and Border Patrol will move inspection operations for commercial vehicles from the current Raul Hector Castro Port of Entry to the new commercial port of entry, Andrew Heller, acting Public Building Services Commissioner of the U.S. General Services Commission, said, the U.S. General Services Administration said at the event. The Raul H. Castro Port, which is also being renovated, will continue serving private vehicles and pedestrian crossings, said Eddie Jones, founder of Jones Studio, the architecture firm that oversaw the design of the port. The new port was a project 20 years in the making, Douglas Mayor Jose Grijalva said. Funding for the project will come from the Inflation Reduction Act and the Infrastructure and Investment Jobs Act passed during President Joe Biden's administration, which set aside funding for infrastructure. Douglas is the little city that could, Grijalva said. by overseeing the inspection of commercial vehicles carrying goods such as produce and Velcro from Agua Prieta, Mexico, Grijalva said the new port is expected to alleviate the traffic in the Douglas Business District, which is located near the Raul H. Castro Port. We're looking to be a gateway for the whole country, so not only the state, not only the Maricopa County and Phoenix, Pima, and Tucson, but also northern-bound, Grijalva said. Wherever they want to go, they can start in Douglas. Douglas wants to grow like Arizona, border cities, Nogales, and San Luis, Grijalva said during the event. The new port of entry will create jobs in construction, food services, and retail for local businesses, Arizona-Mexico Commission Board member Miguel Hollis said. This will be a game changer for not only the state of Arizona, but for the city of Douglas and all of Cochise County, Hollis said. Kelly, who attended the event, said the new port would support communities that rely on cross-border commerce and open the door for new businesses. Put simply, this is a big win for Arizona families and businesses, Kelly said. With the implementation of biometric and X-ray scanning technologies at the new port of entry, Guadalupe Ramirez, director of Tucson Field Operations for Customs Border Protection, said he was very excited about the new port of entry. The new port will allow CBP to do its job efficiently and effectively, Ramirez said. The port is expected to be completed by December 2028, Jacob Benier, Drone Studio president, said. The new port of entry will be located 5 miles east of Ministerios Terra de Benedicción, the church where the event was held, Jones said. The project was estimated to cost a little over $325 million, according to information provided by Douglas. Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star, the September 8th, 2025 edition. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.